This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. Now, Kazakhstan is in turmoil after protests have swept the country and have been met by a violent crackdown by the regime. Now, this is a country which was often portrayed by certain elements as a success story in the regime, despite the nature of the dictatorship. Let's just have a little look at some of the footage which we've seen come out of the country as the crackdown against the protests has escalated. Now, impoverished living standards in the country have long fueled discontent. The average monthly salary there is less than £450 each month. And the government announced the phasing out of subsidies for petrol. The doubling of cost sparked these initial demonstrations. Now, as the journalist Peter Leonard has written in The Guardian, it's a country afflicted by huge internal inequalities, with the west of the country contributing a huge amount to the nation's wealth, but resentful at the lack of investment in basic infrastructure. But the protests against these spiraling costs turned quickly into protests against the regime in general, targeting, in terms of the slogans, the former president Nazarbayev, who formally stood down in 2019, but is believed to wield power behind the scenes. Now, we can see and hear these violent scenes taking place in the country, but the regime has shut down the internet and has shut out journalists, so we don't have reliable information coming out of the country. We do know that the president, Tokayev, is portraying the protesters and terrorists, and issuing blood-curdling statements such as, "We must destroy them, this will be done soon." Shoot-to-kill orders have been given, shoot-to-kill without warning, while Russian troops have been deployed at the request of the regime. Now, the regime is claiming order has been restored, but as we know, we don't actually have a reliable picture coming out of the country, given they've shut down the internet and they kicked out journalists. Now, we've got a short show today to talk to a brilliant expert who's going to explain exactly what's happening, because I know most people watching or listening will not know much about Kazakhstan. Many may struggle to identify it on a map. But this is important. It's important we talk about issues in different nations which aren't properly discussed in the Western media, not least when we see huge discontent where people are organising over very substantial economic and social grievances against often brutal regimes. And this is a regime, it should be noted, by the way, which has had, we know it's called in Putin's regime in order to prop it up. But our former Prime Minister, Tony Blair, has worked as an advisor for this regime. He's received millions of pounds from the Kazakh regime and scandalously, years ago, advised the Kazakh president after 15 civilians were shot dead by the regime. So here's the matter. I mean, we know Tony Blair has worked for various regimes, including the Saudi dictatorship. Again, his foundations have received millions of pounds from that particular blood-curdling regime, which decapitates gay men, dissidents, brutalizes women, and is subjecting Yemen to a horrific onslaught, which has reduced it to the worst humanitarian situation on earth. But we can see here's another regime that he has been up to his neck in supporting. and receiving millions of pounds to give PR advice after the regime massacred innocent striking workers and demonstrators. But we want to talk about this in terms of, you know, a country whose people have been all too often airbrushed out of this discussion, such as it is. We haven't heard the voices of people from Kazakhstan enough in the coverage. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to address that balance. As ever, do support us on patreon.com/OwenJones84 to keep the show on the road. I am in Barcelona writing my book, but we will be doing far more in February onwards. But we've got lots of shows throughout the month and interviews, and we've got documentaries from February onwards. So do support us. You can put questions to our brilliant guests using Super Chat. I will read out everyone at the end. Do click on the YouTube link, sorry, I forgot to say, and press like and subscribe, and also download us on the podcast. Okay, that's quite enough for me. I'm going to bring in a brilliant voice, an expert, someone, of course, from Kazakhstan itself, Dr. Diana Kudabegada. I can't say your name, Dan. We went through this in the introduction. You said, don't even try. Just say Dr. Diana. I got it right when I spoke to you before we came on air, and I've messed it up. So that's a sign of my own incompetence. But Dr. Diana, it's great to have you. How are you doing?
Thank you. It's Dr. Diana Kudabegada. Yeah, I'm great. Thank you for having me.
It's a huge honor. Now, as I've said, most people watching or listening don't know anything about Kazakhstan. Very, very little information indeed. So can you just explain what is the nature of the regime which is in charge in Kazakhstan?
Well, yeah, it's very, we tried to find all sorts of, you know, words to describe it, because it's a very institutionalized regime, but it's definitely what's coming out right now. And we used to call it non-democratic, especially in my own writings, but what's coming out right now in terms of the picture, what we're seeing, it's a very authoritarian regime. And what I mean by institutionalized is that it does have a lot of sort of, you know, legal and procedural and formal institutions that are keeping it in place, which is very important. And a lot of the things that President Tokayev spoke about in his speeches since the beginning when protests broke out on the 2nd of January was all about, like, you know, let's keep it in the legal field, which he meant that basically unsanctioned rallies are illegal in Kazakhstan because the law doesn't allow it. So I think it's very interesting to look at and very important to understand that the regime itself is very complex, but it is authoritarian. And then the protest itself is also very complex. So let's put it like that, the relation between the protesters and the regime are very much happening in this complexity of institutional authoritarianism, but also in the fact that people are simply tired of this type of dictatorship where they don't have any voice or any space to channel their grievances. That's why the protest became that space where they could do it.
In terms of the human rights situation in Kazakhstan, what are the kind of rights and freedoms that are lacking? I mean, we've seen presidential elections in which, of course, the successful candidate wins about 97% of the vote, which is the sort of result you'd expect under a dictatorship, which is clearly not having a free and fair election. So just explain in broad brush terms the human rights situation and, you know, how the ruling party, which has ruled obviously for so long when challenged, how it maintains its power formally.
Yeah, I think it's very important to note that most freedoms are restricted in Kazakhstan, of course. As I said already, people do not have the right for peaceful rallies, which is actually guaranteed by constitution, but there's a specific law that sanctions it, and you have to literally ask for permission from your local administration to have a rally. And that's what a lot of sort of peaceful activists and political activists were protesting against in the past few years. So the protest is not unexpected in that sense in Kazakhstan. Another issue is that we don't really have enough independent and free media. That's why the voices, you know, the alternative voices went all online. And Kazakhstan is one of the most digitally connected nations. We have so much, you know, information spread across different messengers. Telegram channels are hugely popular. Our Instagram is highly political. But we don't have this kind of, like, you know, formalized or institutionalized free media in Kazakhstan, apart from maybe one or two voices of independent journalists like Vice KZ, The Village, or that are kind of, like, you know, trying to portray the situation right now. But unfortunately, that's also a big gap. And another thing that should be mentioned, of course, is that there is a huge harassment of political dissent. It is mostly tackled in terms of, like, you know, it's very much localized. There are political prisons. The dissent is hugely crushed. The oppositional political parties do not have access to be registered and formalized in order to run in the elections. Elections are obviously mostly staged and are uncontested, and that's a huge problem as well that caused the wave of political protests that I've been studying since 2019, when the president resigned. So that's what I mean, that authoritarianism is very institutionalized. It uses very formal institutions like elections, like media, like party system, because we have a lot of different parties, but they're all pro-regime. And it basically uses this type of, like, you know, layout of what, you know, a democratic system would look like, but it uses it for its own purposes in order to stabilize and monopolize the whole public sphere for its own use. And unfortunately, that's what's happening. And I should mention that, I know we have very little time, but I should mention that one of the long-term political prisoners in Kazakhstan was released a few months ago, I think in September, and then he died. He spent 14 years in prison, Aron Atabek, and then he died soon after his release because he was, he looked like a human skeleton. And it's very important that you know, there were these political protests, peaceful protests, after his death by a lot of youth movements. And, like, you know, his daughter now, who's now in her 20s, is also part of that political sort of a peaceful political movement called Oyan Kazakhstan, which is Wake Up Kazakhstan. So you see, the problem here, I guess, for me as a political sociologist, is very interesting, is that the regime formalizes and monopolizes so many of these institutions that the opposition, when it forms, or any sorts of, like, you know, dissent when it forms, completely remains deinstitutionalized and doesn't have access to formal institutions, to formal channels for grievances. That's why we're seeing this spontaneous, sporadic protest that then is hijacked basically by a lot of violent groups that are also highly informal.
In terms of discontent before this, I mean, I mentioned years ago a massacre of protesters, which unfortunately, as I said, our prime minister offered PR advice to the Kazakh regime over. Mm-hmm. So where has the opposition tended to go before this? Is there an organized mm-hmm. opposition? I mean, I know there's an oligarch who has tried to position himself, and I know that he is not at all a legitimate opposition figure. So where is, tell me about him and why he's trying to position himself as such. Yeah. And where's the opposition gone? Have there been a coherent opposition movement before this?
Mm-hmm. So it's very important to note that there were sort of, like, you know, oppositional movements in Kazakhstan since the 1998, I would say. That's when the first first sort of opposition emerged. It was the former prime minister, Akhirjan Khanjageldin, who stood against Nazarbayev. But that protest, I mean, like, it was still highly marginalized, and then he left the country. I think he lives in exile either in Brussels or in London right now. And then in 2001, there was another wave that was larger. There were a number of political sort of key figures within Nazarbayev's regime who resigned and formed, they were technocrats largely, and they formed this new movement for democratic choice of Kazakhstan, it was called, and Ablyazov was actually part of that movement in 2001. But what's important about this formerly formalized opposition was that it always came from the regime. These were former ministers, advisors, bankers, oligarchs, all very close to Nazarbayev himself at some point. And then when they decided that the game was no longer working in their interest, they decided to form an opposition to the regime to basically replace the Nazarbayev, but remain, in my opinion, remain building similar, you know, structures of the regime because they came from it. So that's what I call the regime type opposition. What we're seeing with current protests is that it's non-regime. The people who are protesting on the street never had any connections to the regime properly. They were never in key positions. So that's very, very important to clearly distinguish that. So, but with this Democratic Choice of Kazakhstan, they were on the ground for maybe a couple of years. They enjoyed some popularity among people because there was already discontent in 2000s, in the early 2000s. But the movement disintegrated. Different people were imprisoned, Ablyazov including. Different people decided to take, you know, different tropes. And essentially, there was a lot of internal competition within that sort of, like, you know, regime type opposition itself. They formed the party Akzhol in 2005. Then that party sort of got, you know, divided, and then there was the true Akhrol and just Akhrol. We have still Akhrol in the parliament, which is basically a completely pro-regime party right now, with completely different people. Then we had sort of like the Social Democratic Party that existed up until 2019, but also completely discredited itself because people don't know who are these leaders, whether they have still any connections with the president, with Nazarbayev, whether they have the connections to that presidential administration, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of discrediting rumors and things coming out of that. And also, I mean, like, if you have the leader of the oppositional party was a former prosecutor general, I mean, like, how can people trust somebody who was so close to Nazarbayev himself, who plead to Nazarbayev, who was loyal to him, and all of a sudden decided to turn around? So of course that formalized opposition existed for a period of time, but it completely discredited itself. And Ablyazov himself, of course, I mean, again, he's an oligarch. He's somebody who did enjoy a lot of privileges and access to specific funds when he was under President Nazarbayev. Then when he was released from his prisons, he still had access to the bank. And what is really important about this story that the people need to see, sort of not in black and white, but actually in between lines, is that this person managed to, again, gain his a lot of his fortunes under this authoritarian regime, and he became an oligarch. It's very, very important to note that as well. And what's important for me in my research, because I did interview a lot of peaceful protesters before, is that whenever there was a protest, he would come out, and he lives abroad, and he would come out online, and he would claim that he organized it. And a lot of these activists who I spoke to, they say that, you know, for them, it's very much delegitimizing the protest because they don't agree with his agenda. They don't agree with what he's saying, and they actually don't agree with his figure because for them, he's precisely this person who comes from the regime. So how can he fight that regime? So I think it's very, very important to, like, you know, to look into these lines and not discredit certain people who, you know, don't want to be associated with him, who don't want to, and who definitely, it's very also dangerous for them inside Kazakhstan to be associated with him. So I think he should stop playing that on that agenda, because as soon as activists are arrested, the first question the police asks them whether they are connected to him or not. And it's a very painful thing, you know, to be associated with that when you're actually protesting against him and against the agenda that he's proposing. So I think it's very, very important not to discredit the protest movements by associating it with his name.
Now, as we know, the regime is strangling information coming out of the country by shutting down the internet. People can't get in touch via telephone. Journalists are being kept out. What's your sense of, you know, how much support the protests have within broader society? But also, what do you think in terms of the regime now are claiming that they've essentially suppressed the protests, that order of under a dictatorship obviously has been restored. So what do you think? How widespread do you think the sympathy is amongst the general population? Mm-hmm. And do you think these protests have been successfully suppressed?
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we need to take that situation with the huge understanding that there's a lot of uncertainty on the ground right now. And that's the first caveat. And another caveat is that we need to distinguish where were the peaceful protesters and then when they were hijacked by these violent groups. And I think a lot of things that, because, for example, I'm getting a lot of, you know, threads and very much annoying things on my social media right now from people who are completely disoriented and they don't believe that the protest was peaceful. So that's why I think it's very, very important to look into that complexity. So from the 2nd of January, people in Janaozen, where the first protest broke out in 2011, where the civilians killed. So people in Janaozen started protesting peacefully against the rise of fuel prices. But soon after that, they started coming up with these political reforms claims, and they asked for the government to be sacked, and they wanted basically more democratization, and they actually also, what's very important, want to be able to elect their own governors, which are currently appointed by the president directly. And what is also very important is that the regime was going and established a dialogue with these protesters. The protests immediately spread across the whole Mangistau region, which is in Western Kazakhstan, which is a very industrial and sort of like oil-rich region for Kazakhstan. And there was a committee established, governmental committee that came there. Regional governors were talking to the protesters. Everything was very, very peaceful. There was a dialogue on the ground that was happening between the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. On the 4th, different people started coming out in cities, in bigger cities like Shymkent, Nur-Sultan, the capital, and Almaty. And in Almaty, we have, again, a different group of protesters. These are not sort of like, labor unions or anything like that. These are like political activists, social movements, like Oyan Kazakhstan, like Jean-Bulat Mamai's movement, and so on and so forth. But these are, again, unregistered, non-formalized, but definitely movements that exist and who have their own support group. They started coming out on the streets, and there were clashes with the police, although these protesters were very peaceful. They've been protesting for more than 2 years. They never set things on fire. They never fight with the police. They're very peaceful. They just come with their posters, and they usually are getting harassed by the police, and that's well documented. So let's not forget that story. And there were clashes between them and the police. A lot of activists were arrested, beaten up, which is also very important to remember. They were kept overnight. And then on the morning of 5th, I think it was Tuesday, that's when the violence broke out, because there were all sorts of different groups coming in. The looters who were just seeking opportunity, people coming in from outside Almaty, from rural areas, which is also very important. And then this very much organized criminal groups that started. They had arms, they had guns, and they started attacking different buildings, and they started attacking and targeting law enforcement police, but also civilians. So that's very, very important, that these violent groups need to completely be separated from the peaceful protesters who were there on legitimate claims. And unfortunately, what's being painted right now in all this uncertainty that has emerged is that all of it is basically convoluted, and the police harassment of initial peaceful protests is convoluted with what happened with the armed clashes with these criminal groups that do need to be they need to be detained and properly investigated, where they came from, who organized them, who gave them guns, why the army left the city, why there was so much paralysis of security forces on the ground in the first days when violence broke out in Almaty. All of that needs to be thoroughly investigated. But I think with the uncertainty that is currently established in Kazakhstan, people only have access, most of the people only have access to the state TV, whatever state TV tells them they believe. And of course, people are very, very, very much scared, because there are explosions on the street. I'm finishing. And that's what I'm seeing, is that there's a lot of panic, and most people want to paint these protesters as only violent groups, which is very, very wrong. Because again, we need to see into the complexity of things. If you want to only take Almaty, there were at least 4 groups involved in what happened, and peaceful protesters were not involved in clashes with the police. And I think that's something that needs to be highly, highly, sort of demarcated and investigated further.
So apologies, I coughed there. It's actually because this microphone isn't currently working properly, so I'm speaking through my computer, but that's okay. Just a couple of final things. Some are arguing, and I can see this by various Russia-backed sources, perhaps, but also I can see it in the comments, people who are arguing this is actually Western interference. The opposition within the country is being backed by the West. It's a so-called color revolution to install a anti-Russian government in Kazakhstan. What do you say to that whole narrative? Because I keep reading it. So what's your thoughts?
There is a lot of conspiracy theories on the ground as per usual. This is this is one of the processes for any post-Soviet revolutions or conflicts. I don't want to call it revolution just yet because I think it's a failed coup, first of all, and it's we should identify it, especially what happened in Almaty is a failed coup, which unfortunately some of the elite groups, and this is precisely a domestic thing, some of the elite groups decided that infringing and this inciting violence on very much local people, and I'm also here warning and sending my condolences to equally to civilians and to law enforcement officers, because they are Kazakh citizens, and we are, as a country, we're mourning all of them, because this whole horrible tragedy for us. But I think it's a very much internal conflict. It's a power struggle, what we've seen, especially with these violent groups. The protesters and claiming that they were backed by somebody. I mean, this was such a spontaneous protest when if we're talking about peaceful, a part of it, which basically started off in the beginning. I mean, these people don't have any, we don't have an even proper organization. I think that's something very, very important to note, because I've been studying this protest for, as I said, for several years, is that people are basically, in certain movements, they're basically donating their own money because they don't have any funding. They don't have any, organization, formalization. They exist basically through Telegram channels, through Signal, where they can, this is whatever, the space that allows them to remain confidential, Instagram, and so on and so forth. These people are not sponsored by anybody. They don't have special budgets. They, I spoke to a young Kazakhstan activist. They gather in somebody's apartments, and studios, and talk about these things. They're completely non-funded by anybody. Whether they're educated, yes, sure. Some of them are very well educated. They speak English. They've been abroad and so on and so forth. But it doesn't mean that, they were, brainwashed by somebody and so on and so forth. So these conspiracies always resurface. They never found a proper, ground or explanation in Ukraine, for example. So far, we haven't seen huge reports coming out from what happened in Ukraine during Maidan. And I've been closely watching that as well in the past. We haven't seen these, allegations being proved in any other place. So right now, in this point of uncertainty, people can say whatever they please. But color revolution is not one thing that is applicable to Kazakhstan. It was never organized. Yes, the message was the same, political reforms, economic reforms, but that's simply because the structure of inequality and the structure of the society that was just so tired of what was going on in the country in terms of injustices, in terms of poor governance, let's be honest. And if we're talking about structural and institutional things, this is just the response to a very poor governance, where the advisor to the Ministry of Energy basically said, if you don't like the gas prices, why don't you take public transport? And he said that just before the I think it was on Tuesday. And that, of course, angered a lot of people, because they feel that the regime, the government, is not anymore connected to the people and their grievances. So the protest was completely spontaneous. It wasn't organized by specific forces or anything like that. And I think that's something that needs to be, again, remembered before the clashes became violent and got hijacked by these criminal groups who, as I say, are clearly representing a specific power struggle and specific inter-regime power struggle. So and any external forces and commentators who want to bring it in terms of color revolution or any other old outdated post-Cold War frameworks, these simply, my message to you is that these frameworks no longer work, and Kazakhstan is a completely different and a lot more complex case that you're simply trying to simplify and in that sense dismiss the legitimate claims that were there on the ground and legitimate problems that the current regime still has to face once the violence is over.
Just lastly, just some questions from people who are watching. Tad Campbell asks how much the firing of ministers loyal to the first president is just a power grab by the current government. Is it credible he fled the country? And David Barrett asks how can Western nations help the people of Kazakhstan? And Dave asks what the impact of the rise in fuel prices for the people is. I quoted before that the monthly salary is less than 450 quid. So obviously, I would imagine quite a big impact. So just quickly on those, just in terms of the firing of ministers, what people in the West can do and the impact of the fuel prices on everyday people.
So the fuel prices basically, and these were the news reports that were coming in from people themselves in the beginning when the protests happened, when we all were watching it very closely, is that people simply could not afford, majority of people could not afford it in Mangustao region. And that's, I think, is very important because in other parts of the country, people are still using, other forms of petroleum. And it's, but in Mangustao, they simply said that they no longer can afford it. So it's very, very important. Other things, it's not only about fuel. There were other things people cannot afford, basic utilities. So this is a much wider thing than just gas prices. That should be put to bed as well. Whether the firing of ministers would be helpful, whether it's a power grab, as I said, we exist in this formalized sphere and then this highly sort of gray area where nobody has access to what's going on in the regime, what's the decision making, and so on and so forth. But certain people can still speculate. I'm not the one who I'm not a big fan of speculations or predictions. All I can say is that the fact that the former head of the security and a very close ally of Nazarbayev, Karim Masimov, is is detained under the allegations of treason is a huge thing. And that's obviously something that was voiced by the state television and by the regime itself. We have to wait for the investigation. We have to wait till proper court hearings, whatever these are. And we have to watch them closely in the coming days. It's too early to come up and jump into conclusions and how the Western nations can help. By stop spread, and that's not only to Western nations, but just in general to the commentators who have only found out about Kazakhstan like yesterday when it became a huge news. I guess maybe try to contextualize a little bit, and that's also not only to Western nations, but also to a lot of commentators outside Kazakhstan who did not know the situation on the ground before. Is the situation is a lot more complex. This is not a color revolution. This is not the simple scenario that we've seen before. This is not Libya, Egypt, or anything like that. We do call it locally Kazakh Spring, Kazakh Koktemir, but not in connection to Arab Spring, but in connection to Prague Spring, because a lot of activists who were on the Kazakh Koktemir movement, and as I call it, political field, they were demanding gradual changes and gradual reforms. They didn't want any bloodshed or any revolutions like that. So I think it's very, very important to look into the context, to look into a little bit of history. These protests are not spontaneous, they didn't happen overnight. The level of inequality and grievances have been building up for at least a decade. Please look into what happened in Janaozian in 2011. There are a lot of roots of what is going on right now in that conflict, in that sort of riot and clashes with the police when civilians were killed. There were a lot of more protests in 2014 with the devaluation of local currency that was called Black Tuesday. There were land protests in 2016. And then when the president Nazarbayev resigned in 2019, this was the beginning of the Kazakh Spring, sort of the call for gradual political reforms and democratization brought by the young movement, to which the regime was responding slowly. That's where we see the listening state, so-called, some of the changes and reforms that Tokayev was proposing, but unfortunately they were not enough. And I think another thing that is also very, very important, and thank you for mentioning that, is that the hypocrisy defines it all, that Tony Blair himself was the advisor to Nazarbayev when all of these protests were happening, especially in 2011. And let's not see things in black and white. There's a lot of Western involvement there as well. And like Tony Blair, like other big companies and big interests. And that's also something that shouldn't be escaped. And Kazakhstan shouldn't be considered as this exotic or strange case. A lot of the things that are happening in Kazakhstan are also reflections on a huge crisis of democracy that is happening elsewhere as well. And I'm sorry for being a bit harsh on that, but I think it's something that needs to be mentioned.
I think it's extremely important, very, very important. I'm glad you did mention it. Dr. Diana, that was fantastic. And I think anybody, as I've said, the vast majority, and it's shameful to a large degree, but people weren't aware of what was happening on the ground in Kazakhstan. And you're quite correct. A country like Kazakhstan suddenly appears in the headlines. All of a sudden, you get various people who become armchair experts without actually understanding what's happening on the ground. And more importantly, voices like your own aren't elevated in the way they should be, which is why we're so glad that you were able to take part today and give an actual informed view as someone from Kazakhstan who actually understands the broader context, historical, social, economic. So it's been such an honour. And I can read through the comments. People are hugely appreciative of this masterclass you've given. And I hope, solidarity, of course, with those fighting for a genuine Democratic Kazakhstan, and voices like yours will be ever more important, of course, in that struggle. But we really, really appreciate it. That was really, really brilliant stuff.
Thank you. Great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Take care and speak soon.
Bye.
Brilliant stuff. Really honoured to have such a fantastic guest who can speak so knowledgeably and with such depth and in a very accessible way as well for those of us who don't, who should know more about what's been going on in Kazakhstan. Not least, as I've said, because the fact that our former prime minister has been paid millions of pounds in order to whitewash the reputation of this regime should make it more of our business than it already is in terms of supporting the protesters in Kazakhstan. What was pointed out at the time with Tony Blair's advisory role is it gave an air of respectability to the regime that they could say, well, look, we have this esteemed former British prime minister who is working with us. So how can we be the brutal, terrible regime that people portray us as? So regardless of what actual advice he's given, the fact that he was in any way associated with the regime gave it a kudos and respectability that it simply does not deserve. So it is important that we talk about that. That was a brilliant interview. I've learned a huge amount from that, and I'm sure many of you have as well. It's a short show today. We will, as I said, I'm here writing my book, which I'm now going to go straight back to. But we will be doing the show throughout the month. I think we're going to try and do twice a week, partly just to keep me company because I'm on my, you know, I'm not trying to make myself a victim here. I'm obviously in a brilliant, beautiful city with one of the most densely populated cities on earth. But I'm here to write my book, as I've said. But we will do other interviews as well, just to keep things going until February, where we'll be doing things with a bang. Lots of documentaries, interviews, features, and podcasts. So I'm going to leave you all to it and go straight back to my book. But thank you for that amazing guest. Thank you to everybody for joining us. And thank you to David, Dave, and Tad. I will speak to you during the week. But everybody, take care. And do keep, as I've said, look out for sources from Kazakh people themselves. That's what we try to do here. I've gone on social media. There's a lot of people in Britain and the United States who've become overnight experts on Kazakhstan. I would never presume to be one myself. The whole point of the show is we hand the mic to someone who actually is. But look out for those sources. Do follow people like Dana on social media, and you will have a far better view of what's going on than most Western media sources. So do that. Take care, everybody. Lots of love, and I'll see you very soon. Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you found that informative, educational, interesting, and I certainly did. Do support us on Patreon to keep the show on the road, /OwenJones84. Leave us some stars, that'd be nice. Spread the word. And I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.